How's your bra? Is it comfortable? Do you have a bra? It's not too tight. Because if you loosen it if you want. Take it off, sure. Go on. Would you like a cup of tea? I'll tell you what. I'll make the tea and you take your bra off. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, today, that was, of course, me channeling Father Dougal Maguire from Father Ted, and it was him interacting with a woman who was supposed to be Sinead O'Connor. And, of course, interacting with a woman was rather difficult for Father Dougal because he was a celibate who had arrested development and had nothing to do with women from a very young age indeed. So he was extremely nervous, and Father Ted had to tell him how to behave in front of women, and he told him to be himself and make sure they're comfortable. And so the bra incident was an example of him making sure that they were comfortable. And this raises the question of one of my patrons on Subscribestar had a very good idea for a video. And if you subscribe on there, then you can send me ideas for videos. I'll almost certainly do them. Which is, what is the psychology of religious celibates? Why do certain people become religious celibates? Why does religious celibacy exist? And that is what I'm going to look at today. What is the psychology of religious celibates and the evolution of religious celibates? Before we do that, I'm going to change my shirt and tell you about our sponsor.
Before we start, I'd just like to say a word about our sponsor, and that is Atlas VPN. Now, here's the situation, chaps. We are all truth seekers here at the Jolly Heretic Public House. We all want to know the truth about the world, and the only way we can do that is if we get lots of different perspectives, lots of alternative perspectives. And we are in a situation where we cannot get that. The internet is censored, everything is censored, and we literally cannot get the other side with regard to certain important events that are happening in the world because of the way that they censor the internet. So the only thing to do, as far as I'm concerned, is to use a VPN. And Atlas VPN is currently running a huge discount. It means you can get a 3-month subscription for just $1.83 a month, plus 3 months for free, with a 30-day money-back guarantee. And so time is running out, so it's worth looking into, really. There's lots and lots of benefits to this. Not only is that you've got that deal, but you could unlock your favourite content from all over the world. You know, shows from friends or whatever it is you like are using Atlas VPN. You can keep your Google searches private. They make sure that your results aren't tracked and so forth. You can stop ads and malware. It's more than just a VPN. It blocks malicious links and ads and so forth. And it notifies you when someone's trying to steal your data. And you can save money online. It notifies you of the best deals. And it can protect unlimited devices. So it seems to be a jolly good idea. And as I say, they've currently got this campaign where it's just $1.83 a month. So, you know, it's worth thinking about. $1.83 a month for a 3-year subscription, plus 3 months for free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Time is running out, so, you know, it's certainly worth looking into. So as a person that is in favour of the truth and wants as much as many different perspectives as possible and is finding these blocked by our current system, I think getting a VPN is worth doing. And as far as I can see, Atlas VPN is where it's at, chaps.
Okay, I've changed it back, and now we can continue. So, what is the psychology of religious celibates? There was a very interesting paper called The 5 Factor Personality Traits in Catholic Priests, and what it found was that people who are Catholic priests, compared to highly religious laymen and compared to the non-religious, are particularly high in the personality trait agreeableness, that is altruism and empathy. They are particularly low in extroversion, that is feeling positive feelings strongly. They are low in openness, which tends to involve being open to new ideas and sort of basically being liberal, and they are particularly low in the neurotic traits of anger and of impulsiveness, and they are also extremely low in neuroticism. So they are highly mentally stable people. So this is interesting because they're making what can be regarded as a maladaptive decision in evolutionary terms, i.e. to not have children, but yet they seem to be extremely high in the general factor of personality, which is high agreeableness, low neuroticism, high conscientiousness and whatever, which we have been selected for in pre-industrial times. Now, another paper looked at this was called Personality and Vocational Motivation, and this looked at Catholic seminarians And this found that they are very, very high. Well, this makes sense, that they would be. They're very high in intrinsic religiousness. So there's two kinds of religiousness. There's intrinsic religiousness, which is that you really feel it. You are really strongly, you really feel the presence of God, and you really feel that he's real. And then there's extrinsic religiousness, which is that you are religious because of the social benefits for it, and you don't really believe it, but you sort of socially conform in order to attain what were historically the social benefits of conformity. Unsurprisingly, it was found that Catholic priests were very high in intrinsic religiousness, and they were relatively low in extrinsic religiousness. Where they were, and there were some that were high in extrinsic religiousness, they were high in neuroticism. Now, that makes sense, because neuroticism is feeling negative feelings strongly, and one of those feelings might be social anxiety or whatever. And so you have it, or maybe anger or jealousy or a desire for status in some way. And so you have a strong desire to conform to something which will give you status, and this is what motivates you to become a priest. So the extrinsic religious people were high in mental instability. That makes sense, of course, in general. People that are engage in religious activity in order to be seen to do so have some motive to do so, and often it's social anxiety, it's a desire to conform, a desire to fit in, or because of they think there's social benefits to it, and that's motivated by jealousy and status hunger and Machiavellianism and things like this. But in general, that was not the case. In general, they were high in intrinsic religiousness. They were also high in certain elements of openness, which contradicted the other study. In particular, what's known as quest orientation. So it's almost as if they saw their life as a quest. They saw their life as a journey towards something great, towards something important. That quest orientation. They saw their life as a pilgrimage, almost as a process towards something amazing. And they were very, very high in this. Now, why would these traits be associated with being extremely religious and being a religious celibate? Well, in terms of the agreeableness, in which they are very, very high, they were also very high specifically in the subtrait of tenderness. So they're very, very high in basically empathy. They feel the feelings of other people. They feel. Now, what this means, if you're high in empathy, is that you notice external signals of internal states. You are very, very attuned to external signals of internal states. You are interested in external signals of internal states, and you kind of are able to feel how other people feel. Now, taken to an extreme, you have something that you find among schizophrenics, who of course tend to be extremely religious, which is hyper empathy. And if you have hyper-empathy, then you will be so empathetic that you will notice external signals of internal states in the world itself. So you will notice evidence in the world itself of internal states. You will notice, if you like, evidence of a mind behind the world. Now, which is of a set of feelings, as it were, that are reflected in the nature of the world itself. And that, of course, means that for you, God is very, very real. There is all the time. Some people, they when they are highly stressed, when they are high in stress, and when they are high in mortality salience, then they become more instinctive. And one of our instincts is to over detect agency, because if you're in a forest and you hear a sound, and you think, oh, it's just the wind, and it turns out to be a wolf, you get killed. If you think it's a wolf and it turns out to just be the wind, then you haven't lost anything. So it makes sense that we are evolved to over detect agency, and this would be associated with agreeableness, because people that are highly agreeable, that are hyper agreeable, hyper empathetic, are going to over detect agency. And so therefore you get this relationship between the two traits, and you're going to get very, very religious people that will over detect agency, not just instinctive, not just when they're stressed, but will do so all the time. And what this will mean is that for them, God is absolutely real. He is so real. He is there all the time with you. He exists as sure as I'm riding this bicycle. He is definitely there, to the extent that you would want to totally dedicate your life to this. It's so real that you would want to dedicate your life to it, and that it wouldn't be okay. Of course, it's difficult to be celibate. Of course, almost all men are going to have sexual desires, but it's much easier for these people to suppress their sexual desires because they are so high in empathy. Also, it could be that their testosterone levels are just quite low, because one of the things that predicts being high in empathy is basically low levels of testosterone. So is the low sex drive. Those two things are associated. Being high in testosterone makes you low in empathy. It makes you low in agreeableness. It makes you aggressive. It makes you competitive. It makes you hard-minded rather than tender, tough-minded rather than tender-minded. It makes you the opposite of being high in empathy. And so those two things could be associated. So we're basically talking sort of quite feminized men. But basically, even so, it would the existence of God would be so real to you that you would have a potentially a desire to dedicate your entire life to it. Now, the other thing then that the other study that was found was this quest orientation. Now, this is an aspect perhaps of openness, and there's some evidence that people that are very high in openness traits, openness is a bit of a mixed bag of all kinds of things, but what it can include is being very hypnotizable and very able to have religious experiences. In essence, we have kind of instincts, and if you hit of the existence of God and whatever, and you can feel those more strongly if you are hypnotized, because then you are kind of highly instinctive, and prayer is a means of doing that. And so these people, through prayer, will again be able to feel that the existence of God is intensely real, is very, very real. So if society then says, well, in order to dedicate yourself to this, you have to be celibate, then those kinds of people, they're so intensely religious that they will be prepared to do that. So that's really seems to me to be why certain people would be prepared to be religious celibates. But there's slightly more to it. Let's look at how could this work in evolutionary terms. From an evolutionary perspective, it's a total dead end to be celibate. So it should be selected. Any desire to do so, even in the context of being religious, should be selected out of the population. So how could it stay in the population? Well, there's a number of possibilities. One that I've looked at is what I call the gay shaman theory, which is that there is evidence that religiosity is strongly elevated among homosexual men. Homosexuality is heavily overrepresented among Catholic priests. It's heavily overrepresented seemingly even among tribal shamans, and it's heavily overrepresented even among Buddhist monks. Now, people, as I said, people that are homosexual, male homosexuals, are more likely to be extremely religious. And so if you then enforce celibacy on them, so if you say that homosexuality is unacceptable or whatever and they can't practice it, you enforce celibacy on them, then what you have is a group of people who are dedicating their lives to the religion of the group, to inspiring the group religiously. And what the group tends to do, what the religion tends to do, is it tends to take that which is adaptive at the group level and make that into the will of God. It tends to basically take group orientation and doing things for the good of your group, making you basically high in positive and negative ethnocentrism, and it sanctifies that and it makes that into the will of God. So it's more likely to, so that in the battle of group selection, we know that the group that is high in positive and negative ethnocentrism is more likely to beat the other group, all else being equal. And so therefore, with this religiosity, you're elevating it, and what these people are doing is they are inspiring the group religiously to think that they are the best or whatever. And so therefore there would be a benefit to having this celibate religious caste that dedicated themselves completely to the religious good of the group. And if that was also correlated with homosexuality, which it seems to, and if homosexuality among adults was totally forbidden, which unacceptable, which it generally is, it's okay, to a certain extent, it depends on the tribe we're talking about, but it kind of basically is. Pederasty seems to be okay in various tribes, but not homosexuality of the same age. Then you can see how those two things would come together, and you would have selection potentially both for homosexuality and religiosity concomitantly, and you would therefore have this celibate cast that would be group selected. Now, another idea with the evolution of homosexuality is what's called gay uncle theory. This is the idea that if you have a gay uncle, then the sister of the gay uncle is more fertile, and so therefore having a gay uncle stays in the population and homosexuality stays in the population. Now, this could be this theory has been developed in a very interesting paper called Religious Celibacy Brings Inclusive Fitness Benefits with regard to Tibetan monks. So if you look at Tibetan monks, what will often happen is that the older son, fine, he inherits the farm or the business or whatever it happens to be, and the younger son is sent off to become a monk. Now, this makes sense. The older son will therefore be more wealthy because there will be fewer children. There will be fewer people to inherit. So therefore, the older son gets more. And then the older son, in a society in which women are going to sexually select for status and wealth, and in which there are harsh evolutionary conditions, and therefore you're more likely to survive if you have high status, the older son is more likely to survive and pass on his genes. And so it gives an evolutionary benefit to the family. Now, what's been found is that parents that send the younger son off to be a monk end up with more grandchildren. So it is to the evolutionary benefit of the parents. Parents that do this, that send off their, and they send them off, by the way, at a young age. And there is much celebration, and there is a great deal of shame if he drops out of the monastery. And so it's this important societal thing that the younger son at a young age is sent off to the monastery. There's much celebration. It's considered a high status thing for the young son to do. But it's in the evolutionary interests of his kin. It's in the evolutionary interests of his parents, because the result is that those parents end up with more grandchildren. So you think, OK, the children, but they end up with more descendants than is the case among the parents that don't do this. So that is how then celibacy and this idea of religious celibacy could get into the population, because if it's pursued, then those that do it end up with more descendants. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that it's not the child's choice at all. The child is sent off at a very young age. This is the case, by the way, until relatively recently, until the 30s or 40s, even with priests, well, even more recently than that. So people like Father Ted or Dougal, they may well have been sent off to a school that would prepare them to be a priest at the age of about 12, and certainly no older than about 16. And so that they would have had therefore nothing to do with girls from the age of about 12 or maybe 16, whatever. They would have had a kind of an arrested development. So you can see how this would cause problems. But there was a degree to which it's not their choice. It's the parents that decide that they get sent off. So that's the difference between what's happening now, which is that it most certainly is the choice of the priests, the people that are becoming priests. It selects for certain personality traits, like very high agreeableness and very high religiousness. That's the case now. They're at least 18, and normally they're older than that. I had a friend at school who became a Catholic priest, and he went to first of all, he turned up and said at age 18, I want to be a Catholic priest. And they said, no, you're far too young to make a decision like that. Bugger off, go to university. Enjoy yourself. So then he went to university for 3 years, came back and said, OK, I still want to be a Catholic priest. And they said, no, bugger off. Go and work for a few years. Go and do a job. Go and get a girlfriend. And then come back. And then he did. And then finally, when he was in his early 20s or 23 or something like that, 22, then he was accepted into a seminary. And interestingly, that person, as I understand it, is now no longer a priest and has got married. But it's dropped out. But you can see then how it would stay in the population. Now, another thing that it's doing, of course, which is interesting, is it's reducing intermale conflict. Now, we know that a society which is high in positive and negative ethnocentrism dominates the other society, so you have to have males cooperating. Now, males are not going to cooperate if there are too few women. They're going to fight. And so there's going to be a low level of positive ethnocentrism, and this is going to be a danger. So one way you can deal with this is by having a cultural ideal whereby you reduce the level of intermale competition by forcing there to be a celibate caste, by getting some men and that they are celibate. And again, it's been argued that this is how homosexuality could stay in the population. One of the things that's been found is that a child is more likely to be homosexual the more older brothers it has. And the argument is that as the mother, the male fetus emits these masculinizing hormones, the female's immune system reacts with feminizing hormones. And as this happens more and more, it reacts more and more strongly until you get to a point where the fetus is feminized and therefore is more likely to be homosexual. And so that's one argument for how homosexuality stays in the population, but it would also be an argument for how a desire to be celibate or being extremely religious, being a feminized male, which, by the way, there was a study which myself and Gerhard Meisenberg did where we found that the psychology of religious people, of religious men, is more feminized, even in their intelligence. Their intelligence is more feminized. It is more linguistically intelligent and less spatially and mathematically intelligent than is the case among controls. So what you could have then with the reason why celibacy stays in the population is that to the extent that it's males that choose to be celibate, is that it helps to reduce inter-male competition. One, two, that it helps in terms of group selection and inspiring the group and so on. And three, clearly, at the level of the kin, that it helps to focus wealth into one child and to push the other one, who will anyway be more likely to be less masculine, into celibacy. So I think that's where it comes from. So isn't this interesting? And as I said, as a person that went to a Catholic school, I've met a number of these celibate types in my life. I had a teacher, for example, who was in what's called a numinary member of Opus Dei. It's basically like a secular monk. You live in an Opus Dei house, basically like a monastery, but you are a layman. You're not ordained. And you flagellate yourself every so often, and you wear a cilice on your leg, which is basically barbed wire, and you engage in fasting, and you take a vow of celibacy. And this person, in my experience, extremely high in agreeableness, a very kind, sort of feminized, a committed, dutiful man who fitted precisely the psychology of these kinds of priests that we've looked at before. So that's where they come from, and it may seem like an evolutionary dead end, but it isn't. It works at the kin level. Your kin is more likely, it seems, to have offspring, at least in under harsh conditions, if one of the brothers is celibate and a priest and or a monk. And your group, perhaps, is more likely to be dominant. So that seems to me where clerical celibacy comes from.
Hello, hello, hello! The Jolly Heretic is an online public house which meets on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 PM UK time, 2 PM New York, in which we discuss the kind of based, fearless science which is increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. If you would like to help the Jolly Heretic public house, and there are many ways you can do so, please, please, please become one of my patrons on Subscribestar. Also, if you want to, you can donate to the channel using Odyssey and Entropy, and you could also purchase Jolly Heretic merchandise, such as shirts and mugs. All of the links are in the description. Again, I'd be most violently grateful if you could assist the Jolly Heretic Public House, and I will see you all soon, and goodbye!